Good morning. Nikki and I are going to share this, and if you can't hear me, just raise your hand and she'll take over and do the whole thing. So what we're going to talk about now is birth beyond the borders. Vaginal birth after cesarean, VBAC, is a short form of vaginal birth. Neither of us have any disclosures. Basically, our purpose today is to talk about the literal and the figurative borders that women have to cross in order to gain support of vaginal birth after cesareans. We think that this fits in very well with the larger issues that we've heard about today about reproductive choices for women. We find that actually the issues about women choosing where and when to have birth and how to have birth face many of the same restrictions when women are trying to choose what kind of birth control they can have access to and understand about, and also when they're choosing to terminate a pregnancy. Many of the same kinds of issues that women face about discounting their ability to make choices, not having accessibility, not having information about evidence-based care, are in effect all throughout our reproductive cycles. Mothers are experiencing some of the most significant barriers to accessing evidence-based care in the United States today, and midwives, both direct entry and certified nurse midwives, are facing some of the restrictions on providing the best evidence-based care that we know about today. The C-section rate in the United States continues to rise. It's now over 30%. The World Health Organization, somewhere between 10 and 15% is considered adequate for women who are don't have risk factors. The rate should be somewhere around 4%, so we're way over the top on this. One of the factors in the rising rate is the reduction of vaginal births after C-sections. Used to be fairly well accepted that women could have a trial of labor and deliver vaginally after a C-section, and that's becoming more and more restricted across the United States. There's been studies looking at VBACs and compared to repeat C-sections. In general, a VBAC is considered often safer than elective repeat cesarean. There are lots of issues about cesareans are major abdominal surgery. There's adhesions. There's risks of hemorrhaging and other kinds of problems. There's a 4% higher four times the risk of dying with a C-section as compared to a vaginal birth. And in general, the rupture rate is about less than 1% in most cases for having a vaginal birth after C-section. About 75% of women attempting a vaginal birth after C-section will have a completely uncomplicated delivery. And the risk of serious complications rise when labor is induced and augmented by artificial means, which is something that very commonly happens in hospitals, and can increase the risk for women having a bad outcome with a VBAC. The last time this was looked at, it was 2005, looking at what kinds of policies and restrictions were in place. About 300 policies at the time. 300 hospitals had instituted policies to ban VBACs, and that was rising at the last time it was looked at, and currently is being measured again, and probably within about a year we'll know where it is across the nation. Many women believe that if they want to have a hospital birth, their only option is to have a C-section, and so there's not a lot of good information right now for women to make an informed choice. Some of the issues that happen, regardless of where a woman wants to have her birth, is that a lot of women who want to deliver vaginally are dropped by their care provider if they refuse to have a C-section. So you'll have women who are in sometimes a third trimester of pregnancy suddenly having to run around and find another provider. And any of the issues you've heard about in some of the other talks about stress and pregnancy support and pregnancy and those things about pregnancy outcome, this is giving a very difficult period for women and not doing things that are going to promote the best outcomes for them or their babies. Women have rights concerning the treatment when they enter the hospital. For instance, you're not allowed to turn away a pregnant woman, no matter what she says she wants to do when she shows up at the hospital to deliver. But women often are unaware of their rights and often have very little recourse when those rights are violated. And there's a lot of coercion that can go on when women enter the hospital wanting to have a VBAC. In several states, licensed midwives have been counseled against attending VBACs, and that's curtailing also the home birth options for some women. So many women decide if they can't have a VBAC in the hospital, they'll try to have it at home. There's many states where there are licensed direct entry midwives who at one time were able to do these VBACs, and those are becoming more and more restrictive. There's a small but growing number of women who, in order to avoid some of the interventions that commonly happen at hospitals, want to have VBACs at home. The safety of home-based VBACs has been questioned, but right now there's very little evidence-based care research that shows that they're at any higher risk. And there's been very little evidence-based policy that's been enacted. There have been policies that have been enacted, but nothing that really has any science behind it. There are borders as far as state regulatory law, and this is not a listing of every state, but a sample of states from which we have information where VBAC is now explicitly illegal for home birth midwives. And you can see the states listed here. I'm going to save my voice and not say them, but you can look at them. Another barrier and border is malpractice insurance. In many states, their women, licensed midwives are allowed to do the VBACs, but they must have malpractice insurance in order to do it and to be licensed. And many insurance carriers are now excluding VBAC as something they're allowing their licensed midwives to do, which means that if a licensed midwife wants to practice VBAC, she loses her malpractice coverage and then she's no longer licensed. So Washington State is an example where that is going on, and they're actually being prohibited in practice, even though in theory they're allowed to do this. There's also borders of medical monopoly and obstetric oversight. States where VBAC or also home HBAC, which is home VBAC, is legal dependent on OB oversight, an obstetrician who will oversee and sign off on the birth. Generally, first of all, they look at a woman has to remain low risk according to a point system, get signed off by an OBGYN, and in some states, the VBAC itself is considered high risk. In other places, it's not considered high risk, and there's a lot of contention right now in the literature about whether that makes you automatically high risk. And then midwives, that's in Florida and Tennessee and California, the examples are that midwives just need to secure backup by an OB. In practice, however, fewer and fewer OBs are willing to provide this kind of backup. Here's an example of a birth in California. The woman could not find a midwife who had OB backup. She had the home VBAC done with an unlicensed midwife who was well trained but had chosen to practice as an unlicensed midwife, so she wouldn't be restricted by the backup rule and was thus able to do VBACs. A lot of other midwives have just chosen not to do VBACs at all because they can't get this backup, so this option is becoming a shrinking option for women. There are also borders for barriers to informed choice. American women right now are really denied access to obstetric intervention data that would provide informed choice, and it's the same kinds of things we're seeing with information about abortion, information about family planning, information about how to handle menopause. There's just not a lot of information out there. And right now, only New York and Massachusetts legally define a consumer's right to access birth practicing data, basically data that tells you what's the C-section rate in a hospital, what's the VBAC rate, what are easy episiotomy rates and other kinds of interventions, so that you could say this hospital or this provider might be more like what the way I want to give birth, and that you can make an informed choice about where you want to go. What I'm going to turn over to Nikki now is to talk about the South Carolina cases where we currently live and some of the relatively recent changes that have gone on for VBAC in our state and what it actually plays out to in real women's lives.
Thanks for hanging in there, Catherine. So what are the consequences of the restrictions in South Carolina, for example? The restrictions change practice for licensed midwives and the type of care that they're able to give. And this changes options for birthing women. This family, for example, wanted to have a VBAC, and they had to search for networks within and outside the state for guidance. And many are finding it hard to find a provider who will truly support hospital VBAC. And now those women who want to VBAC are finding it harder to do so at home as well, where home birth midwives are reluctant to support illegal births. In this case, the original cesarean was for a breech presentation, which is also outside the scope of home birth midwifery. And the family attempted an external cephalic version, which failed. They faced post-dates and a lack of informed choice regarding prenatal testing, which drove them to seek home birth midwifery. At one point, the family was driving 4 hours one direction for prenatal care. And when a location for birthing remained insecure near term, the midwife agreed to attend the birth in South Carolina, thereby committing a felony as she was not licensed in the state. During a postpartum transfer to their local hospital, Child Protective Services was called, and the hospital called local licensed midwives inquiring about their possible relationship. And the mom and the baby were separated for over 3 hours despite a lack of medical necessity. This baby never breastfed. This was Allie's first unassisted birth after cesarean. The cesarean was due to a cardiac anomaly found in the baby requiring immediate repair, very necessary. However, three of Allie's four girls were born unassisted thereafter due to a lack of midwifery care. Mother notes that the first unassisted birth was necessary since she was post-dates and would have been forced to induce or have a repeat cesarean. Allie and her family regret that they are unable to publicly celebrate their birth plans and stories due to fear of investigation by CPS and being dropped by their pediatric care practitioner. They worry about the day they hope never comes, one where they require intervention during labor. This is a case of crossing literal borders. Katie's cesarean was a home birth transport for hands and feet presentation. When she and her family learned that they would not be able to gain access to home birth for their next birth, they accessed care in a neighboring state where midwives are unlicensed. The family was required to temporarily relocate while the father commuted from South Carolina for work. While the family had a great experience overall, it came after extreme and unnecessary financial and practical burden. I just want to touch on some of the specific challenges that families face due to these borders and what black market births are costing women, babies, and their families. The families expend extraordinary amounts of time, worry, and financial resources going into the planning, which means that some families are traveling 3 and 4 hours one way for prenatal care, or their midwives are, and there are some dangers inherent in that. Some families relocate temporarily. There can be a resurgence of depression and feelings of hopelessness that are common. Trust between women and their care provider is very difficult to achieve due to an inherent level of dishonesty that happens in making these plans. Marital conflict can spike, and even fathers or partners can withdraw during this time because of their own feelings of helplessness. Women experience feelings of extreme isolation from both the mainstream and natural birth communities. Children of the families may experience some neglect as the parents are consumed by the stress associated with illegal birth practices. And women and families often face challenges within the system with child protective services and acquiring birth certificates. With all of that said, so why would families go to the length of planning this type of birth? And I just wanted to share with you from a book that the International Cesarean Awareness Network published, and it's stories of women who've had cesareans. And a mother writes, she says, "The moment that was supposed to be the best moment of motherhood and the culmination of my joy in pregnancy and my love for my daughter turned out to be the worst moment of my life because of horrifying pain from inadequate anesthesia. My only thought when she was taken out and flashed at me fast was, thank God, now I can go. I didn't care about her, except that now my torment would end. I didn't care about what happened to her. I didn't care about being a mother. I just wanted it all to end. I wanted to die. And I'll never forget them. I'll never forgive them that they took my unbounded joy in new motherhood from me and the peaceful, joyful welcome to the world my daughter should have had from me." So this is the experience that the families have, and they go to great lengths to avoid that. So our recommendations are that access to the provider and setting of their choice be made available, that facilities must provide care without hostile VBAC bans or de facto ban policies in place. And what a de facto ban means is that while the facilities don't have a specific VBAC ban policy in place, they're able to, in effect, ban VBAC because of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology's recommendations that 24-hour anesthesia be made available. Consumer advocates and public health policymakers must ensure that policies are in place to protect consumers' right to access chosen care, which says sort of the same thing that that we're pointing out. And I would like to also add that we recommend that researchers form alliances with advocates to access the families and do some more study, and the advocates would be necessary because these families are very reluctant to share their stories for obvious reasons. And finally, data needs to be made available to the public to ensure accountability, improved outcomes, and opportunity for informed choice making. We already know that transparency improves outcomes, and it's a pretty simple measure to take toward that end. There's another slide, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. That's what you were looking at before.
Yes. Toward that end, the Coalition for Improving Maternity Services, or CIMS, is working to bring maternity care back into consumer hands through the release of state obstetric intervention data and the collection of that, and an online consumer feedback called the Birth Survey. You can find information on the table in the rear about that. Thank you.
in regard to your original comment, there was a survey called Listening to Mothers 2 that you might want to review, and what they gathered is that that the idea of patient demand cesarean is rather overblown, that in fact it's not as common, I think, as we might believe. That being said, I personally, outside of the organizations that I'm involved with, absolutely support a woman's right to determine her reproductive health. And if that means that after a review of the data that she chooses with cesarean to be the most appropriate choice for her, I support her right to choose that. And the second thing that you asked, I believe, was about data collection.
Has there been a systematic report of what proportion of OBs and midwives actually offer VBAC, as well as
Well, I think that, you know, because of variation from state to state in terms of the challenges that are specific to those communities, that you're going to have different populations in terms of what support actually looks like. In the communities that I live in, for example, I'm only aware of one hospital that actually outright has a ban in place. That being said, you know, when we're looking at VBAC and being truly supportive of a VBAC, there are things that go into supporting those births that are rather counter to, I think, American obstetric practice in terms of allowing women to labor longer. VBACs tend to have quite a bit of emotional dystocia associated. And I don't know that many OBs who are going to just sit back on their hands while, or nurse midwives for that matter, simply because of the constraints that they face while a woman just labors away, despite whatever monitoring says that saving another is fine. There are limitations there. So we need to look further than policy. We need to also look into practice guidelines.
I do think most states do gather data about those rates, but it's not currently very accessible outside of what other health department or whatever is handling that information. And there certainly are states and pockets of places where this is not much of an issue or a problem, but I think the vast majority there are those limitations.
And you bring up a good point. If I could just also add, you know, in a state like South Carolina, it's going to be really difficult to quantify the number of women who are demanding home birth after cesarean, for example, because their birth certificates do not reflect that they had a midwife-attended birth. They're going to, for the most part, say unassisted birth, whether or not that birth was actually unassisted, whether or not it was actually planned, if that makes sense. It's really difficult to gather data.
We have about 12 minutes, so we can open up questions for the whole panel, if you have any.
When these women who are becoming informed are choosing home birth and having fairly good outcomes, I think that that's one of the factors, is that they know when they walk through the door that they're facing multiple interventions, which are linked to higher rates of fetal
consumption. Can I just comment too on that? I'm up in the position of obstetric So who should choose? Who should choose which risk they would rather take? Who gets to make that decision? And a VCC section after a C-section, you've had a previous C-section, is an elective surgery. And we have hospitals that are saying, we are mandating an elective surgery regardless of what the woman wants. We're mandating, even though there's significant evidence to show that number one, feedback is safe, and the risk of C-section, they're not significant. And the question is, who gets to choose? I was actually the chair of the OBP's committee at my hospital when all this controversy came up in 2003, and I brought it to the ethics committee. I'm like, how can we as an institution ethically mandate that women have an elective surgery if they choose to accept the extremely small risk of a catastrophic outcome with a feedback? How can we do that? And I was very clearly overridden by everybody else on the committee voted to ban feedbacks. And I was saying,
what did the ethics committee say?
They said, they wouldn't talk about it as an ethical decision.
It is an ethical decision.
I know,
decision.
And I kept saying, what are the ethics about it? And their response was, yes, but if we get sued because of a catastrophic outcome, then the whole hospital goes under. And for the community, that would be a very poor outcome for the whole community if this hospital is unable to support itself due to a catastrophic outcome. That was their only response. They wouldn't talk about ethical decision making.
Yeah, but ethical decision making is about, the doctor-patient relationship and the best, the best decision for that patient in that circumstance, and that's it's a participatory decision making process, and it's actually both the doctor and the patient.
It should be, but we haven't said it that way.
Well, and the evidence base is more about whether the hospital gets sued or not, and not what's the best outcome and choice for women and their babies. So the whole idea of, meta-analysis, et cetera, I think are looking at what's the health of a institution, not the health of moms and babies.
Right. And we practice defensive medicine in this country, and it's a horrible situation, actually.
And our presentation shows the trickle-down effect that not only are we looking at defensive medicine practices and public health policies in institutions, but now women are seeing that in home birth scenarios, because when you have a care provider who is facing repercussions for attending an illegal birth in the same way that a provider in an institution is facing repercussions for malpractice suits, it changes the quality of care that women have access to. All of the arguments about risk are centered around the provider. Because as you say, they're not centered around choice for the consumer. And that's our recommendation, that supporting choice, puts the power back into the consumer's hands so that they can take more responsibility.
Other questions? Okay, well, I'd like to thank our panelists. It was an excellent session. I think really very interesting papers. Thank you all. Really interesting papers, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Moderating.
Yes.
It's all on the website. Wonderful. It's all audio, video, everything else recorded, whatever they did. No, I mean, what's driving all these decisions? The lawyers are saying, we're not letting this happen because the situation in America is that we are the most litigious society on the planet, which means everything's litigated, everybody's suing everybody else. They're last ones of lawyers, and all they do is, survival. So, you get these crazy, decisions in a trial where the law cause such damages in cases can be millions and millions of dollars.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
When you do you have to do anything? Ready? Everything's ready?
Okay. Yep. If you want to be a moderator, all you have to do is say, I'll be a moderator. We're actually supposed to do a little more than I did.
Local legalize the only way to do it. I mean, that's, you know, if you go to the state.
Okay, bye.
Yeah.
Grassroots.
Oh, we try to be.
So that's the next moderator.